Welcome, everybody. This is Henrik. Thank you so much for tuning in today. RedIceCreations.com is the website, and we continue to report on the utter chaos in Europe and the total destruction and intentional teardown of what has been built by our forebears. I have a few things I wanted to share with you today before we start our program with Jess Turner. So I hope you don't mind a few minutes rant here from me today. I wanted to play you guys some clips before we begin to set the groundwork a bit. You know, we dedicate a lot of time to the topics that not only is examining ourselves and our history and what we have been doing wrong to end up in the situation we are, but also to those who hold power in our world and what ambitions and goals they have. We look at how they have been so successful in engineering us in so many ways that they have, to have so many of us go along with it all for such a long time. In recent times, we have become aware of an area that almost no one talks about, yet there is ample evidence for it. We've spoken about the lie of diversity and also about the mechanism of control that the global establishment are imposing on our nations, our people, that is, by creating conditions of chaos within it. You know, multiculturalism is one of the biggest lies ever sold to the European people, of having them, to a large extent, just give up their own country and territory without basically standing up and fighting for it. So after years of being engineered and programmed with what we're supposed to think about all of this, and, well, it's very complicated, and how are you supposed to react? What is okay? And, you know, all these different things of strange explanations and intricacies of cultural Marxist brainwashing in order to explain why it's all happening. You know, we can make any silly, stupid excuses all day long as much as we want. Only a hopelessly brainwashed individual in these times would keep telling themselves that the emperor has clothes. It's only the fresh young mind of a child that would see things clearly as they truly and really are. And we haven't even seen a beginning of the problems yet that are going to come and fully bloom out. The full consequences of us dropping our guard and running scared into the corner, trembling at the prospect of being called a racist, a Nazi, or a bigot, or an anti-Semite, or whatever other epithet they throw at us in order to shut us up and have us comply with their agenda. That's what it's about. You know, there's an out-in-the-open slow genocide ongoing that no one talks about. It's about replacing the populations of the European nations. That's the goal of Kudinov-Kalergi, the founder of the European Union. You know, that is the goal, and they do it right now in many different ways. It's one of the most heinous, despicable agendas that we are faced with right now, and it deserves every minute and every hour of airplay and time that we can dedicate and give to this subject in order to awaken people to this murderous agenda that no one wants to recognize, much less talk about. It's not going to be our mission to establish every intricacy of this insidious agenda here today. There are many levels to it, and we've spoken about various parts of it in previous shows, and it can be quite repetitive to summarize everything every time or to add a disclaimer to every single show. You know, sometimes for certain shows, you just want to go right to the heart of the matter with the guest and hear what they have to say about the mess that we find ourselves in. So as we begin this show here in a little bit, it probably might seem that we kind of start from an assumption that you are brought up to speed on certain things and that you know what's going on. And I believe most of our audience is at that level. But I do know we have new people tuning in all the time as well. And that's kind of why it's important to preface certain things again and again to make sure that, you know, the listener understands that there is a foundation for some of the claims that a guest build further argument on. So I wanted to give you just a few examples, if you will, of what Jess Turner, our guest here today, is going to keep as a, well, theme throughout this program. I want to play you some clips here at the start, folks, that are openly advocating the termination, transformation, and end of white people, and that somehow we deciding over the destiny of our own people in our own country is something that's wrong. Folks, this comes natural to every single people, wherever they are on the earth. They do things for their own, and they set things up for their family and the extension, their people in their country. But now we are to be reduced and removed, not only from the lands of our ancestors, but from the very face of the earth itself. And there are a number of people I want to play to here, and they have one thing in common, except being anti-white, of course. And we'll see if you can figure it out after we've listened and translated a few of these.
My concern is doing away with whiteness. Whiteness is a form of racial oppression, sure. The suggestion is that it is somehow possible to separate whiteness from oppression, and it is not. There can be no white race without the phenomenon of white supremacy. If you abolish racial oppression, you do away with whiteness. Treason to whiteness is loyalty to humanity. To me, whiteness is an identity that arises entirely out of oppression. Whiteness is not a culture, it's not a religion, it's not a language, it's simply an oppressive social category. And the task is to bring this minority together in such a way that it makes it impossible for the legacy of whiteness to continue to reproduce itself.
Well, that lovely man is Noel Ignatieff. He's a professor at the Massachusetts School of Art, and he published a journal called Race Traitor with the motto, "Treason to Whiteness is Loyalty to Humanity." The introductory issue had an article called "Abolish the White Race by Any Means Necessary."
Immigration is the future, moving populations. So you have to really make a good policy of immigration all over Europe. And we see this, that the history of Europe, with this long history of nationalism and small countries, is now getting into a crisis. So this will need a long time. You have to really change the policy of immigration inside Europe. This is very important. You have to adapt the educational system and adapt all the self-understanding of the states. They are not anymore only white or only Swedish or only Portuguese or only German. They are multicultural places in the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, let's take her words and change them just as what she said at the end there. They are not anymore only brown or only Jewish or only Chinese or Malaysian. They are multicultural places in the world. Yeah. So isn't that interesting? She only mentions European countries. This is another extremist fanatical Marxist, and her name is Anetta Kahani, and she also shares something with the other people we'll play here.
I think there's a resurgence of anti-Semitism because at this point in time, Europe has not yet learned how to be multicultural. And I think we're going to be part of the throes of that transformation, which must take place. Europe is not going to be the monolithic societies that they once were in the last century. Jews are going to be at the center of that. It's a huge transformation for Europe to make. They are now going into a multicultural mode, and Jews will be resented because of our leading role. But without that leading role and without that transformation, Europe will not survive.
It's always fun to touch in with Barbara Spector, you know, who made it all the way up to Stockholm, you know, long from where she should be in the occupied territory of Palestine. She recently was caught tweeting, "End white people." And then when people caught her, she actually backpedaled on that too. But I think the strong point here, the takeaway from Spector here, is of course that Europe won't survive without immigration. That's right. That's why we were, you know, suffering for so many hundreds of years, you know, because we didn't have good access to third world immigration. That's right. I mean, it's finally now that things are starting to get better and better in our modern world. I mean, just look at Sweden. Things are getting better and better each day because we're getting more and more immigration. I mean, I was completely wrong. I didn't realize it. Now we can. I mean, now I can survive. I mean, I'm surviving now. Okay, time to listen to some Nazis here now.
Meine Damen und Herren, Schöner Leben ohne Nazis. Vielfalt ist unsere Zukunft. Am 6. Juni in Neuruppin um 10 Uhr teilzunehmen. Wir müssen uns gegen die Nazis stellen.
Die Nazis. That's right. This is a politician who lives in Germany. Gregory Gysi. The left is his party. Die Linke is the Partei. Diversity is our future, right out of the gates, he mentions in the video. And it goes on to say, every year more native Germans die than are born. And that's very fortunate. It's because the Nazis are not very good at having offspring. So he calls all native Germans alive today Nazis. And of course, because of Germany's history from 1933 to 1945, they must take in many, many, many more refugees. I mean, this history is well established now, if you've been paying attention. I mean, the official history is unquestionable on this. He also managed to bash Poland in the video because they are Catholic. I mean, that's practically like, you know, being Nazi Germany. And they need to also to take in refugees. But, you know, if you haven't guessed it already, what these people have in common is that they are all Semites. Well, they call themselves, whether they actually are that or not could be argued, but, you know, if you criticize them, you're called an anti-Semite, so I would just figure then that, all right, they would classify themselves as Semites. But there's more, and we don't have audio clips of these, but it turns out that the president of the Jewish community in Oslo claimed last year that Norway is too white. President Erwin Kuhn said that, you know, something has to be done to teach them white racists there in Norway about diversity, because, you know, that level of whiteness is just unacceptable. And then recently we had another lady in Pittsburgh who also said that Pittsburgh is too white, and it turned out that she lived in a very wealthy Jewish neighborhood far from all the diversity that she is advocating. When you have people openly speaking about this agenda, but not a word is said in the press to denounce it or to go after the people who spew such hate, well, then you know that something is horribly wrong with the media that we have and the environment of people being unable to address and speak about this issue. And you can also figure out that someone wants to keep it this way for a reason. They want to keep it quiet. They want to keep it out of the press and out of people's minds. There's other of these kinds of scenarios too. You know, Portland in Oregon was also too white, apparently. Even Wesley Clark, the ex-NATO general, while he was bombing Serbia, mentioned that the time of homogeneous European nations was over. And it turns out, too, that he was a Semite. So you're telling me that we're not supposed to talk about this? And, of course, the response is usually to turn on the messenger that basically brings this to your attention. But let me tell you, this is just the tip of the iceberg. No pun intended. But please tell me, how can they speak like this, and why do they speak like this? Why is no one reacting to this? If this would have been any other group, there would have been an immediate outrage. These people would have been lynched and sterilized and hung up in a tree by their intestines. Why can they speak like this, and why do they speak like this? Is their ethnic interests what lies at the root of this? If they have grown up hating Europeans and thinking that everyone is a Nazi out there to get them, maybe they unconsciously are pushing for these kinds of murderous policies and celebrating what's happening, but it must be conscious, right? And furthermore, you know that you have power and privilege to be able to speak this way and not be reprimanded for it, when not even as much as a small article in passing is written about this in the media. Can you imagine if this was said by a European, a person in government, in Israel, or speaking to a Jewish community somewhere? And this is the main point that I want to bring to your attention before we begin the program here after this long intro now. But the amazing hypocrisy and media omission on this kind of hate is just extraordinary. I mean, what happens? Instead, they turn on people who oppose this kind of stuff, and they try to convince you that those who oppose this kind of stuff are the problem. It's just unbelievable. But here we are, and perhaps even more scary, you have thousands upon thousands of white brainwashed Europeans cheering along in the death choir, celebrating them becoming a minority in their own countries. Folks, something is horribly wrong, and it's time that we start speaking openly about this and addressing the issue head on. If we don't begin and recognizing what is going on, we are never going to be able to stop it and actually do something about it. But the statements from the people that you've heard is absolutely unacceptable, and we are calling them out on their hatred and their disgusting genocidal opinions. It's time that you start talking about this with your friends and your family members and get this out there. We are not going to spend our entire show on this alone. We have a lot to discuss today, from the invasion in to England from Calais in France, the Eurotunnel crisis. We're going to go from there to talk about the state of nationalism in general, both in Britain but also in Europe. We're going to discuss the Shomrim, the private police force of the Jewish community in London, something that started in New York City. But yep, that's right, they have their own police force developed in cooperation with the London police. But don't say anything about that, because that's hate. Well, Jess Turner is the organizer of the London Forum. You might have seen some of their videos online, some great speakers that come to the Forum. They have a YouTube channel where you can find out more. He's a speaker himself, and you might have seen him in the news lately, as the honorable and truthful media have been depicting him as a grandeur hater for daring to address the Shomrim. We'll talk about that later. And also how the European Union is choking the life out of the European people. Welcome, Jess. Thank you so much for coming on the program. It's great to have you here. Hope you're doing well today.
Yes, thank you very much. Honored to be here.
Thank you for all your hard work with the London Forum. You've hosted some great thinkers and speakers in our times that are addressing some of the most vital issues. You're doing very important work. And of course, you've been doing a lot of speeches lately as well in London and some of the other places as well that we definitely want to ask you more about later and get into some of that. But it's just such a mess, to be honest, that it's kind of almost difficult to know to where to begin, because there are so many pressing issues. But why don't we begin with what's kind of most topical, if you will, and talk a bit about what's going on in England right now with Calais and the Eurotunnel, because it's interesting to have seen that the mainstream media is now even turning and addressing and begging the politicians in England to actually do something. How bad is it there?
It's very bad. I mean, there's always been a phrase in England, you know, and this phrase, it's an old phrase, and it's the wogs begin at Calais. And it's not quite sure what people mean by this, but it always meant that, over the Channel, you know, that's where the wogs begin, or in theory they could begin. They could walk across the world island to Calais. And it is madness down there. It is madness. I mean, I've had phone calls from friends living in Kent. You've had chickens stolen from their coops and, you know, petty theft and things. You know, these immigrants coming over in their thousands, getting through the Channel. That was only built in 1994. When it was built, when it was being built, the National Front was saying back then that all this would happen. You know, it would lead to, it was just a walkway for immigrants to come in. And they're coming in here in their thousands. They're attacking people, robbing. It's an invasion. They're not migrants. They're not refugees. They're not asylum seekers. They are invaders. This is how invasions, how wars began in the past. Back in the ancient times, you'd get families, small groups of people crossing a border, robbing, causing mayhem, and then the king would have to get an army together and repel them, and then there'd be a massacre and so on and so forth. These people aren't coming with weapons because they don't need to. I mean, the government's letting them in, you know. Yeah. As long as you get through that fence, hey, you've got everything. Free council house, free benefits, you know, a white woman laid on, no doubt. You've got everything. And these people are coming, and these traitors in Westminster and Whitehall are letting them in, you know, sending down. I mean, David Cameron gave a speech last week saying, oh, I'm going to send down a few more sniffer dogs and a few more bales of barbed wire to stop them. That's not going to stop them. The first job of any government is to defend the borders. You know, that's what the government's there for. That's what the army is there for. And if they're not doing that, someone else has to do it, you know, because they're not performing their function. They collect enough taxes off us. And it's absolute lunacy. I mean, we've got, you know, your Swedish government is saying to people, saying to Britain, you know, we must accept more people. We must hurry up the destruction of our country, you know.
Yeah.
Madness, you know. I mean, you know, Calais is a mess. You know, there's 5,000 there. They just don't know how many are coming through. There's so many coming through.
Right, yeah.
It's stupid. You know, the army should be there. Look, I always, you know, people say, Jez, you're a bit of an extremist. I'm not extreme enough. I mean, I look at history and I think, what would famous white heroes do to repel this sort of stuff? And I look at people like Vlad Tepes, you know, Vlad Dracula. I mean, what did he do to slow down the Turks? Well, there's a famous story about Sultan Mehmet II in 1462. And he got to Vlad Dracula's territory, and he saw a forest of 20,000 impaled corpses outside of Vlad's capital. And the Sultan felt sick and turned back, went home, you know? So, yeah. You know, it's getting to this sort of stage now. We're entering sort of race war, ethnic conflict, or we would be if the government wasn't preventing us from defending our territory. You know, we're right. Getting to this case of, you know, the old ancient world where, you know, you've just got to do anything you can to defend your territory, really.
Well, you know, about Vlad and Dracula and all that stuff, people think, you know, that was extreme at the time, but they never kind of mentioned what triggered that so-called extreme response and what the reasoning was. And if
exactly.
If you isolate something in history like that, of course it doesn't make sense. But, you know, and hopefully in our times it doesn't come to that. But what are France and Britain doing differently today as opposed to, well, 1995 then, I guess, when it's been up a year, and that, I guess, at that time they were still managing to hold people out because the police are acting like, oh, we can't do anything. We're helpless, right?
Well, they're only helpless because of the stupid laws. There's something called the Schengen Agreement, which means within the European Union, there are no borders, which essentially means there are no borders anywhere because the countries at the edge of the European Union just haven't really got effective borders. So people just walk from Asia, Africa, they just walk through and they jump on trains, buses, they come straight through. And once they cross that first border, they're free. They do what they want. And France is saying to us, the mayor of Calais, you know, Madame Bouchard, whatever her name is saying, oh, it's Britain's fault because they're not letting them in. You know, we're not letting them in. It's our fault. So if it wasn't for that bit of water called the English Channel and this Schengen agreement, they'd all be here. We'd be flooded. You know, it's a ridiculous situation. The people are in France, from my point of view, as a nationalist point of view, it's France's problem. France should not have let them into their country.
Right.
You know, but it's these stupid European laws. The European Union is designed to destroy Europe. The European Union is designed to destroy the European race. That's what it's doing. Don't look at what a person says or what an organization says. Look at what it's doing. And that is what it's doing. The whole purpose of the European Union is to destroy the white race. Simple.
Well, you know, Kudenhof Kalergi, he did speak about that in the early days, and that's even before the official formulation of the European Union back in the, you know, after World War II, basically. But he was writing about this in the 1917 or 16, I think, one of his books there was released about this, talking about a, you know, European unity. And I think he worked closely with the Habsburgs as well at the time. But, you know, he spoke about this idea of basically destroying the European race and breeding us out, making us mixed race. So, you know, if that's one of the tenets they're still adhering to, they're basically following that agenda, you know?
Of course. I think they are. Yes. There are a lot of fools in the world, you know. I think liberals actually are... Well, the lower down liberals are fools. But I think I do take heart from the fact that I think nationalists are actually the most level-headed element of any population. The rest of the people who go along with whatever's happening can be the most extreme. What I mean by this is, at the moment, they're the most, you know, supine, cowardly, brainless dolts. You know, they're not putting up any defense, they're not even criticizing it. But when things get bad, they will switch into the most bloodthirsty white version of Attila the Hun that's going. And we saw this in the Indian Mutiny back in the days of the so-called British Empire, more like the Rothschild Empire, when the Indians had an uprising and began slaughtering whites. All these white missionaries and do-gooding white liberals were the most bloodthirsty people going to get revenge against the Indians. So, you know, I think things can change very quickly. I've always said this people at the extreme can suddenly find themselves in power, and people in the center in power can find themselves pretty quickly dead, you know. So most people don't understand what's going on. We understand, and the Jews understand, but the rest of the people just don't know. But when reality bites, you know, when they start suffering, at the moment that, you know, they're not really suffering. I've had middle-class friends saying, oh, it's terrible down in Calais, terrible. And I say, oh, yes, it is. It's terrible. It's terrible. They go, yes, I can't go on holiday. What? What? That's all you care about?
Yeah.
Yes, I want to drive down to Monaco. Can't get there. Huh? And it's like, oh, my gosh, you know. So bring it on. Bring it on. Give me more reality. Come on, let's have some more pain.
Exactly.
Let's wake these people up.
Is that kind of that let them eat cake kind of approach here? But, you know, before we speak more about what is happening in Britain right now, I wanted to ask you just a little bit about your background. I suspect many in our audience as well are interested to hear both when and also why you started the London Forum. And I don't know if that's the first thing that kind of entered you into this path, but tell us what got you to that point, Jez.
Oh my gosh, there's always many, many reasons for everything we do in life, isn't there?
Oh yeah.
I was at a demonstration recently giving a speech, and the opposition was shouting, boring, boring, boring. And I was genuinely shocked by this, Henrik, genuinely shocked, because I'll take you back about 20 years when I was a school child at a fairground, and me and this 10-foot ginger-haired gorilla, you know, he was what we call a brick shithouse in North Yorkshire. He was a tough man, you know, and he was coming for me because we'd had a disagreement over this girl, and he came for me in this fairground. And I thought, oh, here we go, you know. So I found myself, you know, getting clobbered on the head. You know, he was bashing me like this on the head. And I was, oh. So I began punching him in the stomach like this for all I was worth, you know. And rather like you're bashing away at a dam, you don't know when this dam's going to burst. You keep punching away. And then suddenly he collapsed, you know. Then I was punching him in the face. And I won, and he was staggering away, and his friends dragging him away. And this girl who knew me was going, this new girl, I sort of know, says, oh, my gosh, I didn't realize you were so tough, Jez, and you know, I thought you were boring. And this other girl, nearby said, say what you want about Jez, but he's anything but boring. So I've always been a sort of adventurer. I've always done things. I see something and I do it. Something needs to be done and I go and do it. So when I was at school up there in North Yorkshire, and I saw the Asians coming in, I saw the blacks coming in. I lived in a place in between Lancashire, which is a very heavily Asian area, and West Yorkshire, Bradford, another bad area ethnically wise. And I was in a white enclave in the countryside in the middle. I saw this and I was unhappy about it. I got to university, the University of Essex of all places, which is known as a left-wing Trotskyist place. I got there and I thought, what on earth is this? What? This is madness. This is lunacy, you know? Okay, all these people at university, these left-wing lunatics, they all agree on one thing. They hate the far right. So I'm going to find out about the far right. So I went to the university and I got all the library there, you know, got all these books out, and it was all written by Cohens and such people. But I sort of thought, well, I've got to see what the so-called nationalists, the so-called fascists, the so-called neo-Nazi, these despicable far-right people, what they say. So I tried to find books written by them. But you can't find them, can you? You can't find them. This is back in pre-internet days. So I eventually tracked down the National Front and joined up there and then. So I, you know, my eyes were, within about a year, opened. You know, when I was first told about the conspiracy, shall we say, I was pretty incredulous, as most people are. David Duke was incredulous, but then you you test this view, and you work out it's pretty true, actually. So I developed my ideas, and once you become a nationalist, the film drops away from your eyes, and you can read the obituary columns in the newspapers. You can read anything, and you will see what's really going on. You will see the truth. So I became a nationalist quite early, 18, I officially got involved with the National Front. And I went on a march, a National Front Remembrance Day parade in London. And bear in mind, I was still at the Essex University. This is the left wing, you know, the bastion of Marxism in Britain. I went on this march, and there was a independent reporter, a freelance, who was hanging from this lamppost. I mean, not hanging by his neck. He was climbed up it with his camera and he was taking a photograph. And took a photograph. And because I turned up quite smartly, they said, here, carry this flag. So I was there at the front of the march carrying this flag. And the next day, the Monday, I think it was the Monday, there I was on the front page of this newspaper, you know, and I thought, oh, this is going to be interesting. Oh, dear, you know. Oh, because they knew I wasn't politically correct. They knew that already, you know. But with this front page, you know, photograph, I thought, this should be interesting. But bizarrely, nobody sort of noticed it was me. I was in a crowd of people. The photograph probably wasn't very good quality. And they didn't realize. So I put this front page on my bedroom door in the university, you know, to sort of, as a badge of honor. All my friends knew it was me, but none of the students' union people did, the left wings. So I got involved in nationalism and did various things in Yorkshire, in Lancashire, in London. And then the National Front split up and there was two National Fronts and it was all got a bit confusing. So what did I do then? I had a broken heart, Henrik. I fell in love. I had a broken heart. And what do you do when you have a broken heart? You join the French Foreign Legion, okay? You join the French Foreign Legion, the Legion Etrangere. You go away to forget.
Right,
you
read, right.
You read Beaugest and you've read Ouida's Under Two Flags. So I went along to Knightsbridge and I knocked on the French embassy door, went in there and she says, oh, bonjour. So I got on the phone to the French Foreign Legion and they told me to get myself over to France, you know. So I got down to the coast there and I was passing an army careers office and I walked in and ended up joining the British Army instead. And so guess where my first posting was? Bear in mind, I'd just, you know, come from the French embassy in Knightsbridge. My first posting, I joined to see the world, see adventure, you know, excitement. Mm-hmm. My first posting was Knightsbridge, Household Cavalry, Knightsbridge. So for the next 12 years, I was pretty busy with the military. You've no free time there. When I left towards the end of my career, was coming towards an end in the military, I got back involved and I began to go to meetings. And I have to confess that while I liked the people at the branch meetings of these nationalist parties, the British National Party, it wasn't quite what I wanted. It wasn't quite inspirational enough. It wasn't quite intellectual enough. In other words, the nationalist party meetings were too concerned about leafleting, raising money for leaflets, fighting elections, keeping their voice moderate, trying to win over waivers. And I wanted the real thing, you know, the real truth. So myself and a few friends began the London Forum. And, you know, I've got to confess that the London Forum is not me. It's a group of people. For every actor on the stage, there's 100 behind the scenes, you know. So it's a group effort, and we believe it fills a niche where you can get the truth out there. And then the political parties can do with it what they want. But you've got to create idealists. You've got to create hardcore activists, because without them, you've just got a party made up of paper members,
yeah,
who don't do much. This is always the problem in nationalism: not enough activists doing the hard work. The left. You go to universities, you go to any town. There's about a dozen different hard left groups that will discuss anything, talk anything. Well, within their own parameters. But you'll get some pretty extreme views there. You know, they'll say that Pol Pot was a moderate, didn't kill enough people. You know, you get that sort of thing.
Right.
So we need something like that, because all these people who go to these left-wing meetings, they absorb these ideas and they become a Marxist, Trotskyist, Maoist, whatever they are, whatever they call themselves. You know, they absorb this ideology. And then they go on to join the Labour Party, become a respectable MP and keep their past quiet. Doesn't matter so much in their case, of course, because the press isn't bothered about
exactly,
you know, being Marxist, yeah, you? But they've got the ideology still there, you know. So we've got to do the same thing, really. We've got to do the same thing. It's called metapolitical, you know. So it involves politics, in a sense, not the boring democratic politics, but politics in terms of literature, history, culture, poetry, philosophy, religion, all this good stuff that gives you an inner strength, gets you through the hard times. Yeah, so that's what it was, really. It fulfills a function. We, the quality of people who go is very good, and the numbers are increasing. And it is a lot of work to organize these things.
Sure.
Whereas your street demonstration, you see, is free. You know, you just got to tell the police we're having a demonstration here, and you can go along. And with the wonders of YouTube, internet, camcorders, you can film the speeches, get them on the net, and you've done it for free.
Right.
And it shows you're not scared either. It shows you're not scared. I mean, we had 40 people on Saturday in central London, Trafalgar Square, and we had this demonstration. It was a wreath laying, actually, a wreath laying to commemorate the British forgotten heroes of Zionist terrorism. Because on the corner of Trafalgar Square, there was a colonist club, which is Zionist, a Jewish academic now. He's a professor at the Sorbonne. And I forget his name, Mirazi, set this bomb off and maimed a few people. You know, didn't kill anyone, but he maimed a few people. And he's went on to lead a very respectable life teaching in the Sorbonne. And the Palestine campaign, 1945 to 48, we lost 200 plus policemen and 700 plus soldiers in that campaign.
Wow.
It's a lot of people. Yeah. The King David Hotel killed 100. I mean, David Cameron, in his recent extremism speech, he said that the biggest ever terrorist attack that killed British subjects was 9/11. No, it wasn't. It was the King David Hotel. 100 died there.
Yeah.
667 died in 9/11. And the people who carried out most of these crimes, you know, are alive and well and becoming presidents of Israel. And one of the ladies who was involved in the bombing lived in North London until last year, alive and well, and thriving. These people have never been brought to justice in the main. The victims are not honored anywhere. These 1,000 British people who were killed by the Zionist terrorists, they don't appear on World War II memorials. They don't appear on the fallen after the Second World War, the National Arboretum. There's a monument to British servicemen who've died in post-World War II conflicts. They're not on there. And every year, on the 11th of November, at 11 a.m., members of the royal family, the top politicians, there's a parade in Whitehall, and at the cenotaph, they lay wreaths. All campaigns lay wreaths. Malaya, World War II, World War I, every conflict lays a wreath, except there's one campaign that is not allowed to lay a wreath, and that's the Palestine campaign. So we organized this demonstration, and we laid a wreath. And you know what was very strange about this? Very, very strange. This is that we advertised this rally in advance. It was on nationalist websites. We issued press releases. Everyone was chattering about it. The opposition, the Zionists, the left, all these people, they knew about it. But you know what? Silence.
Right.
No one came to oppose us. No one mentioned it on the websites. There was a complete blanket silence on this. Now, my view is measuring success for demonstrations, events. One level is the complete hysteria, which was the anti-Shomrim demonstration.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I want to ask you more about that later, but yeah.
They go berserk, you know, screaming and spitting. And the other end is the silence. Now, they talk about, you know, they ridicule the so-called far right for believing in a Jewish conspiracy or a world conspiracy. And yet, there was a conspiracy of silence on that. You know, all that happened was two opposition photographers turned up to photograph the wreath laying. So that was very interesting. So, yes, I do speak at a lot of street rallies because they need speakers, and I think it's a good thing. It's a good thing to do. A lot of young nationalists prefer going on street demonstrations than long academic meetings, horses for courses. White people are very varied. You know, one size doesn't fit all. White people we're the most varied race in the world, and that goes for our politics as well, and our tastes. We have to appeal to all of those people. And there's a variety of organizations now. In the past, everyone was in the British National Party. Everyone was in the National Front. And they were too busy trying to fight elections to pay attention to spread the truth. to pay attention to things like the Palestine issue, because resources are limited. But now UKIP have taken over the political angle, and to compete with them is very hard because, you know, they've got masses of money. The press are sort of on their side in some respects. So to compete with them, it's very hard work indeed. But it's given us space. It means we can do other things. We can concentrate on building up an ideological, an ideologically committed activist base and spreading the real truth, you know, without having to worry about losing votes through it or not getting the press coverage we want.
There's a lot of various national parties that have been popping up in England too, and I think one of the other. Well, it's good. I'm not saying that it's active and whatnot, but I guess when the BNP kind of more or less fell apart, it's created a environment where you have, you know, tons of different parties, and they're very small and very few people within them, and it's like is something going to kind of coalesce these these various interests together at some point, you know?
Well, it's possible. I'm very wary of people who talk about white unity. It's usually, you know, under my banner. You know?
Right.
I think it's good there's lots of different parties in a sense because it means all our eggs aren't in one basket. So I'm willing to work with any group that's willing to cooperate. If it's a group that just says, oh, my party's only the good one and you're all wrong, then I can't work with them.
Right.
But what is sad is that 5 years ago, 10 years ago, there was 100 or so British National Party branches, all with 50 or so people coming to regular meetings, doing things. The British National Party fell apart, and those branches fell apart. But those nationalists are still there, but they're not doing anything. Now, the London Forum is quite a good model because we're not in any party. We're not affiliated to any party. We're just nationalists. And I say, well, why can't all these towns that had a functioning branch, why can't they just set up a nationalist group, a nationalist meeting society, a nationalist social cultural thing, and have a meeting once a month? You know, and there's plenty of speakers around. There's plenty of magazines produced, plenty of books, plenty of things going on. But for some reason, a lot of British people, we've been dumbed down so much. We've been lobotomized almost. We can't think outside the electoral process. Nothing to do because we're not going to win an election. Well, what does that matter? You know, winning isn't everything. Enjoying the fight is very important, you know. Stop thinking, oh, when's it going to end? When's it going to end? All these people are coming over in Calais, you know, people, their blood's boiling. They want to do something, you know. Well, you know, do something. Don't just shout at the television. In fact, take the TV and throw it out the window. You know?
Yep.
It's a waste of time. Just listen to Red Ice Radio instead. You know,
good suggestion.
Use the internet. Yeah. But don't get angry, get even. Do something. You
know? Yeah, yeah. Well, that's the big problem here, isn't it? Both to organize, but also know to where to direct focus and being in a situation where you strike at the root as opposed to just thrashing at the branches. There's so many different issues. But I think one of the things you touched upon that is very important is the metapolitical question that, you know, when I think about what is happening in Europe and when I'm thinking about those people who are there to come out to defend European culture and speak proudly of it, I get the sense to a certain degree that there's a lot of people that obviously they just don't care because they don't know what it is. They don't know their history. They're not engaged. They don't understand it. It's almost like our culture has been, well, hollowed out. It's been lost to a certain extent. It isn't, but that's the perception, I think, in most people's view, if they even think about it at all. And so one of the big questions to me is how to encourage something which is awakened again, that you know, exuberates life, where people can look over at it, whatever it is, and say, wow, that's impressive. That's something I want to be part of. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, because people won't defend something unless it's worth defending. And a lot of people don't realize there is a white culture. They think white culture is, well, I don't know. They think it's Hollywood or something. Or
stolen or something.
Yeah, it's you right. know, oh, Lord knows it. You know. But, I mean, I went to pretty good schools, and I had to just to educate myself after I left school. You know, university was a waste of time, really. So it was school. I just learned a lot of nonsense about how the heart works and a bit of maths and English. But you have to really be selective and discover your own culture. You have to find where the real culture is, seek it out, and teach yourself and educate yourself, because you cannot rely on the television, you cannot rely on the schools, you cannot rely on the museums. You've got to be selective and choose the good museums, the good exhibitions, you know. I mean, I went to a William Morris exhibition recently, and the slant was, oh, he was a socialist, look at all these socialist pamphlets. But if you know where you're looking, if you're a nationalist, if you're the film has been cleared from your eyes. I went into that museum. It was the National Portrait Gallery, I think it was. And I went in there, and William Morris used to do paintings. And there's this wardrobe, this big wardrobe with a painting on it. So there were all these people wandering past this wardrobe. Oh, nice painting. Walk it on. But this painting was of Little St. Hugh of Lincoln. It's in a pre-Raphaelite style. And Little St. Hugh of Lincoln was this thing that drives the Jews so wild. It's the blood libel. It's a little boy who was murdered by Jews in a ritualistic manner. And there's a monument, well, there was a monument to him in Lincoln Cathedral. There's now a stone slab with a sign telling it was all a lie. He appears in Chaucer's Canterbury Tales. So there's this beautiful painting of Little St. Hugh of Lincoln being resurrected by the Virgin Mary. But nobody realized what it was. They were wandering past. So, yes, you have to develop. You have to find your culture. That's part of it. You've got to get your thinking straightened out, really, because you know there's several areas which act as stoppers on a nationalist becoming a fully fledged nationalist. A lot of nationalists, they say yes, they're a nationalist, but they whisper it. They whisper it. You know. There's probably 10 nationalists in the same street, but none of them realize it because they don't tell each other what their views are. And I mean, they've got to understand that what they're doing, that they are the good guys. That's the first thing, they are the good guys. And that a nation is like a lifeboat. When the Titanic went down, everyone jumped into the lifeboats, those who could. And each lifeboat had two sailors to it. And these sailors had an oar each. And of course, their job is to row the lifeboat. But they also have another very important job, and that is this. A lifeboat can only take a certain number of people. If it takes any more, it sinks. Okay? So there they are rowing this boat away from the ship, and the sea is full of people trying to get on this lifeboat because there weren't enough lifeboats. There never are enough lifeboats. So if anyone grabbed hold of the lifeboat, the sailor's job was to smash that person in the head, smash his hands, get him away from the lifeboat. Because if you let too many people in the lifeboat will sink and you will all die. So that's the first thing. A nation is a lifeboat. The second thing is this guilt about history. You know, British Empire, well, the British Empire never benefited the British people. You know, British soldiers died like flies out in the tropics. You know, it was the Rothschild Empire. You know, the Jews benefited. It wasn't the white people. Then there's the black slave trade, another issue of guilt, you know. Well, the black slave trade was run by Jews. The Jews owned the ships. Poor white sailors died far quicker than the slaves did, because what happened was the slave ship would go to the slave coast, which was full of disease. They would take the slaves on board, and then they would head towards America. When they got to America, then the white sailors were paid and the black slaves were sold. So think about it. The less sailors you have at the end, the less you've got to pay them.
Right.
The more slaves you have, the more money you make. So it was in the ship owners' interests that sailors died. And most of the pirate ships in that period were sailors who suddenly realized that their ship was going to the slave coast, because they were often taken on, given articles, you know, employed as a sailor in Portsmouth or somewhere, and lied to. Are we going to be collecting sugar or this or that, you know? Halfway through, they were told, oh, we're a slave ship. And they would revolt because they knew it was a death sentence to a white man. to a white sailor. So they would revolt and they would take their chance as being a pirate. So this idea, it's all white guilt, is a lot of rubbish. And then there's the white slave trade. I mean, we're talking, there's two elements. There's the white women who were used as sex slaves, and there's whites who were used as slaves in North Africa. And more whites were used as slaves than blacks ever were, you know.
That's right.
And then you've got to say to yourself, look, what are you so white privilege? What is this white privilege all about?
Yeah.
You know, the Jews own and control everything worth owning and controlling, both in America, both in Britain, both in France, everywhere, really, you know. You know, I mean, basically, I always say our struggle is a global struggle. It's not just about whites either. It's about the whole world. It's about the internationalism does not make sense. Internationalism is something the Jews use to control us. The only thing that makes sense is international nationalism. So I say, look, it's not enough to free Britain from Jewish control or free Germany or free America or free Sweden. You've got to free the world from Jewish control. And then there's the mass media, then there's the brainwashing, you know, all these, a lot of our ideas aren't innate. They are foisted upon us. I mean, look, we've got Alex Haley's book, Roots, about his time as a slave. It's fiction, it's nonsense, you know?
Yep.
And we've got Anne Frank's Diaries, which is written in ballpoint pen, for God's sake. It wasn't invented until after the Second World War.
That's right.
You know, then we've got Harper Lee's To Kill a Mockingbird. Well, you know, that's fiction as well. And then the sequel to that book is actually very enlightening, actually. And then I suppose people feel guilty about the 1930s or fascism, Nazism, all this sort of thing. Well, I'm sorry to say, you know, to burst a liberal's bubble, but these views, which people consider to be Nazi or fascist, have been the views of sane communities, sane peoples forever, you know, the Middle Ages, the Renaissance, way back into ancient time. So, you know, it's all nonsense. And then there's the thing about, oh, Hitler going to take over the world. Well, no, he just bought Europe time. You know, everyone knows that Stalin was going to sweep over Europe and turn it into a communist slave state. But Hitler preempted him. And this has been proved now by archives, you know, and Viktor Suvorov wrote a book about it.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the Holocaust, isn't it? There's the Holocaust. Oh, my gosh, you know. That old joke, isn't there? The difference between the Holocaust and a cow, what's the difference? You know, you can't milk a cow for 70 years. you know, the Holocaust is just a smokescreen to hide Jewish crimes. 100+ million people died under Soviet communism. 7 million German civilians died in the Second World War, and 8 million died between 1945 and 51. But nobody talks about that. Nobody talks about the Holodomor.
No.
Or the French Revolution. So, you know, it's just a smokescreen really to hide what really went on. And, you know, the Red Cross accept that 300,000 Jews died. Okay, and they died in the camps and elsewhere, but they died because the supply lines were blown to bits by the American Air Force and the RAF. Even the guards were dying, and they died through disease. You know, very few died through firing squads or whatever.
Mm.
So, you know, it's ridiculous, all this nonsense about the Holocaust. And then there's the fact that we have races. You know, nature has a purpose. God, call it what you will, the life force, created the races, and he did so for a reason. And to mix them, to allow mass immigration, to allow mongrelization, miscegenation, interbreeding, ends up destroying all the races, all the cultures, and it just turns us into all just a one world, mixed up, miscegenated, McDonald's munching, massive money worshipping morons, ruled over by those who still have culture, tradition, religion, race. So it's not just a white thing; it's the whole world. And sure. I would say to people, you know, don't hate the non-whites who have come to your country and having all the benefits that your society gives them. Okay, you're working hard to pay for, you know, you can't afford to have children because you're too busy paying huge taxes to fund them having children. But don't hate them. Don't hate the Jews, even, who've brought this about. Hate the Jewish agenda. You know, it's far easier to hate an agenda, just people. People, there's good people, there's bad people.
Sure.
But it's the Jewish agenda. It's the global Zionist agenda. Hate that, by all means, you've got to hate. So I think once you've taken these on board, these sort of 10 or 12 facts, these 12 strategies, issues, then you won't feel so worried about your views anymore, because your views will be good views, shall we say, you know, looked at from a modern world viewpoint. You know, you're a good guy. You know, you've got good instincts. Shall we say you're a nationalist, you're annoyed about immigration, you're annoyed about the way the world's going. That is natural. That is good. You know, don't feel ashamed about that. Feel proud of it. Shout it from the rooftops. Go on demonstrations. You know, take the risk. Do what has to be done.
Is it about that we're still too comfortable, that we're in a situation now where we don't really, we haven't had much struggle? Well, I can't say that across the board either, of course. There's a lot of poor people in England too, specifically. I mean, they're old ladies, for Christ's sake. They're freezing to death in their own dwellings because they can't afford to heat it up. And yet, despite that, we were told that somehow they have white privilege and all this nonsense. But my point is, it's, you said something in your speech about how basically people, when they come to a point when they have nothing left to lose, that's when they decide to step out of their comfort zone. And I guess majority of us are not there yet, right?
Exactly. And we don't realize the true state of affairs. I meet many British people who don't realize how bad things are. Most nationalists don't realize how bad things are. We live in a world, a fictional world. We come home at night, we watch television, we buy a mass media newspaper. We are given a sanitized version of what's going on. We don't realize how bad things are. And in a sense, it's propaganda. It's propaganda. Under the Soviet system, we would probably know it was propaganda, but now we don't realize. And so we need two things to happen. We need reality to bite. And we need to basically realize what's going on. Many people in Britain don't realize immigration's a problem. They've never been to Southall, to Brixton, to Tottenham, to Bethnal Green, to parts of the cities. They just don't realize. And, you know, they don't know. So I think reality's got to bite very hard before they begin to realize. But, you know, once they realize, there's nothing left. You know, nationalism, call this ideology what you will, it's the only thing that makes sense. It's the only thing, you know, so the only sane thing going, isn't it, really?
Yeah.
Yeah, so bring on the pain, you know. You open the gates, let them all in. Yeah. I don't want to be a frog, you know. There's too many frogs out there in the water, and the water's getting gradually hotter. And, you know, they're going to boil alive. You can boil a frog alive by putting it in water and turning it up gradually. Let's turn the heat up quickly, you know. Let's get them out of that water.
Well, I think you're right. I think the most tragic thing would be kind of a slow death, withering away of slowly becoming minorities in our own capital cities and then expanding from there, as it is happening in London right now. And then slowly from there, just having no to few children and mixing ourselves out. And one day, if you wake up and realize, or this will happen in increments too, I guess, that, whoops, we no longer exist in the capacity we did before. And that's got to be the worst case scenario, I think.
We don't exist in certain cities in this country. There's no communities anymore. There's no white communities. They're just individuals who drift. Students drift in, drift out. Whites who have a career. They don't have a career. You don't have a career. You're a slave in a system that hates you and is exterminating you. If you have no children, you know, you're going to be extinct. Your particular genes are going to be extinct.
Yep.
If you're not white community, you know, boom, it's game over. You know, I live near a cemetery here, and I can look at the cemetery, beautiful cemetery, nice old gravestones, Victorian graves. Everyone in that cemetery is white. Everyone walking past it is non-white, right? And there are no white children in this area. There are just a few students, a few yuppies. These are young professionals who just live here because it's close to their work. It's over, game over in this area. You know, the white community here has been ethnically cleansed, genocide. genocide, okay? And these women who choose a career, they get to a stage where they think, well, I would leave work and get married, but, you know, only if I could earn as much money as I do now. Well, I'm sorry, you know, if you want to have children, you want to really live life, then you, money doesn't matter. Money's not important. You've just got to do what you have to do. But you see, they're being bribed not to have children, basically, by giving a, you know, they work in an office 9 to 5. They think they've got a career. They think they, you know, but when they're old and lonely and miserable, you know, when they stop working and they retire, then what? You know, they have no grandchildren left. No children. You know, it's a miserable existence.
Everything and that they are, you know, will be lost forever. It's
lost forever,
never to be returned.
Right.
Yeah. It's, well, you know, and it's kind of a, what you said before there too, that it's nothing directly, you know, personal against those people that are there to replace us, at least not in my view. It's a number of things. It's one that we're doing this to a certain extent to ourselves, but we're also being, you know, propagandized into it, of course, and we're stepping away for a number of the reason that you brought up earlier. It's a sense of victimhood and guilt mixed into this. There's a sense, or there's a aspect of basically bad science and fraudulent history of not giving honest answers of who we are or where we come from. And if, you know, you take all these things together, it's to a certain extent, it's not strange that it's occurring. You know,
it's the people who've done this know what they're doing. You know, it's meant to paralyze us. You know, the snake when he goes to the rabbit, you know, he paralyzes the rabbit with fear, then he kills it. That's what's happening. You know, no people on Earth prior to this modern age would willingly allow their country to be trashed, to be invaded, to be destroyed the way whites are allowing it to happen today. No country on Earth, no people would be that stupid. So it is a case of brainwashing. In a sense, it's magic in a way. You know, it's, you know, any alien would think, well, what the heck's going on there? You know? this white race, they're so clever, they're so powerful, they're so just good warriors. Why are they letting it happen? You know, it's we've been mesmerized, really mesmerized.
Yep, it's bizarre. It's let's go back to Calais again and talk a little bit about what's happening there. And what I'm looking at some of the pictures too, I don't see many families there. I don't see a lot of children, maybe teenagers and whatnot, but it seems to be just basically a lot of young men. Do we know where the majority actually are coming from? Are they coming over from, you know, North Africa over the Mediterranean and then walking up through Europe to France and then from there over to England? Or where are they coming from?
Yeah, I mean, Africa and Asia. Not so many Orientals, not so many from China and that place. It's mainly Africa and Asia. A lot of coming across on boats, across the Mediterranean, then stupid charities like Médecins Sans Frontières pick up the boats and bring them to Britain, bring them to Europe rather, you know, and then they get everything and then they head for Britain. But of course the young men come because once they're here, they can bring their families over. You know, that's once they get right. Once they get a bit of paper saying you're British, then they can bring their families over.
Right. I see.
And of course, you know, they're from societies where the men do this sort of thing. You know, the women don't do this. Women are at home with children, aren't they? You know?
Right.
So, yeah, they usually, once they're settled here, they go and get a child bride from Afghanistan or Pakistan or anywhere, wherever it is, you know. But like any invasion, it's the young men who lead it, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is the old tribal invasions of the past where the pressure at home was too much and then they naturally began to move. They would form armed bands and then they would begin to move. They would form camps on the borders and then cross. Days of the Roman Empire, you know, this is what happens. But yeah, Africa, North Africa, Asia, there's a photograph here in the London Metro newspaper, and there's about 10 of them kneeling for prayers. These are obviously Muslims from North Africa, and they're saying their prayers before they have another go at jumping the fence. You know, we don't know how many come in. Don't know. they think 2000 a night come through. Mm-hmm. You know, we just don't know. We just don't know. But as I said, I've got friends in Kent, farmers, and they see them walking through the fields. You know, they phone the police.
Where are they going? What's do they know? I mean, someone has to be telling them this, right?
Well, look, we have this theory of these guys living in mud huts. It's nonsense. These people are from urban areas. These people are the, shall we say, the wealthiest almost of, mm-hmm. of these countries. These people are well informed. They have mobile phones. That, you know, they're more technologically advanced than we are, some of them, you know. and often they're the worst of their countries. You know, they're the criminal type class people. The good people stay at home in the country and try and sort the country's problems out, you know. These people who have nothing to lose and are often criminal types, you know. I remember there's a chap called, who wrote a book called Fu Manchu. Fu Manchu, was it Sax Roma? I forget. Anyway, he mm-hmm. wrote this book about this Chinese evil genius who was taking over the world. And he was criticized for writing this book. And he said, no, you know, these Orientals in the East End of London, they've been kicked out of their own countries. They're so bad, you know, and they've come here. And there's this good film, I think it's set in the 1930s in Hollywood, where Fu Manchu harangues the non-white races of the world and says, you know, your destiny is to go to Europe, conquer and destroy, conquer and breed, rape and breed, kill the white men and take their women. Fiction, but this is what's happening. It's human. It's natural, basically. It's the way the world works. We're not defending our borders. We're not defending our women. They're coming and they're taking. And that's what's happening. But it is beginning to cause a few raised eyebrows among people. They're beginning to worry. And yes, what you say about the press is very true. If you look at the press now, the mass media, they're saying the sort of things that the nationalist mass media was saying 20 years ago.
A bit too late. But yeah,
too late. Yeah, too late. I mean, they were imprisoning nationalists for saying these things 20 years ago. Yeah. Remember Nick Griffin? You know, people criticized Griffin, but he had lots of ideas, lots of energy, and he was the first person. He was the leader of the British National Party. He was the first person to point out the Asian gang rapes of white children in the northern cities, the grooming, the you know what was going on there, and the government took him to court to prosecute him. But now all the papers are saying this now, you know. He wasn't sent to prison, he got away with it. But now all the papers admit it's true. So it's always the nationalists who are the spearhead, the vanguard of the news stories. And then the press think, okay, we can say it now, you know. We can, even David Cameron called them a swarm, you know, swarm coming from Calais.
Uh-oh.
Oh, he's in trouble with that.
He's
yeah.
in trouble, yeah.
Well, like all liberals, they don't know what the current politically correct ideologies this week, you know.
Right,
it's moved
to,
on.
They have to
it's
check moved. In somewhere and see what,
they have to.
What's okay
have
this
to.
Day. Yeah.
it's continually moving further left. In Glasgow, Scottish city in Glasgow, they had a gay pride march 2 weeks ago, gay pride march. And they have actually banned drag queens from the gay pride march. Drag queen is a man who dresses up as a woman.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay, that's what they are. They sing in pubs and things, but that's what they do, okay? Anyway, they've been banned from this march because it offends, drag queens offend the transgender people. I don't understand it, Henrik. But anyway, it's getting complicated now. It's getting very complicated, you know? It's getting, nobody knows. Even the most politically correct person has to check up on what the situation is this week and what the next, you know.
It's true. Yeah, I mean, it's really bizarre. I mean, we had this gay pride parade through a Muslim area in Stockholm, and it's hilarious to watch this and to watch the labeling, if you will, on the groups as well, or at least one of them. But so apparently what's going on is that it's this kind of, you know, quote, far right, unquote, group now in Sweden that are arranging a gay pride parade through the Muslim area. And so on one side you have the full on, you know, card carrying cultural Marxists and the hippie socialists. And then on the other side, you have this far right, I guess they're conservatives to a certain extent, of Sweden, who are trying to, you know, criticize Muslims but not immigration by joining up with other social justice warriors here. But it's getting so confusing. I think especially for them, they can't seem to make heads or tails about what group in the equation is the more suppressed one. So it's kind of tricky for them now to realize which side they should go to join up with against traditional Swedish society, you know?
Yeah, it's very interesting. There's a chap called James O'Brien who's a disc jockey on a talk show radio, LBC in London. He's a dreadful chap. He ticks all the boxes, you know. He's really bad. And he was a bit confused because there's this thing called a shomrim, which it means Jewish type Sharia law, shall we say, police in a Jewish areas of North London. And callers were coming on saying, look, if you're saying this is okay, why can't we have our Muslim Sharia police in East London?
Right.
And I was saying, well, yeah, that's fine. And then he was getting Jews saying, oh, this is disgusting, you can't allow this. And he was like, oh my gosh, I've messed up, what am I doing now? What's the politically correct line? Help, you know? He was confused, yeah. You know, panicking, you know? You could tell he was mixed up. So it is getting very confusing. There was the Gay Pride in London march. Sponsored by Lloyds Bank, and you had banners everywhere. London welcomes gay people, and all this, like, the railway stations. And you had a UKIP party, which is probably the same as this conservative party you're talking about in Sweden. UKIP had a gay pride section in the march.
Mm-hmm.
And Peter Tatchell, the traditional leader of the group to make homosexuality compulsory or homosexuality legal for 7-year-olds or whatever, you know, he's that sort of person, was outraged. This sort of very mild sort of nationalist party was having this, you know. But more interesting, there was one marcher at the front of the march who, you know, you had these flags at the front, I don't know, flags of countries that had legalized gay marriage or something, I don't know. And this guy grabs a Confederate flag and he's there waving this Confederate flag at the front of the march. Oh, and there was pandemonium, apparently. Pandemonium, you know. And the white gays were, like, confused, but the black gays jumped on him and beat him up, you know. And the police then dragged him off and told him off, you know. He was the one who was attacked, you know. The police are confused as well. They're not quite sure what to do, you know. Well, he's a gay. What do I do? Oh, my gosh, he's gay. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. Can't touch
the front headquarters. What do we do?
Oh, my God. Yeah. It's hilarious. Yeah. They've created a monster that's now starting to attack itself. It doesn't know where to turn now. But, well, Jess, we're going to take a break here in a little bit and continue to talk more about all these topics. I want to ask you a bit more about Shomrim and the talk you did there. I think people need to know about that. But before we break here, please give us some of the details of where people can, you know, find your work. Tell us a bit about the London Forum, if there's anything upcoming you have, or anything else basically you'd like to let people know about, if there's a way they can, you know, help you out or get in touch in some way.
Yes, I can give you an email, London Forum, all one word, @yahoo.co.uk. Also, you can go on YouTube and look for the London Forum channel. There's some videos on there. We also have a Yorkshire Forum. We're sort of spreading out, and I'm encouraging other towns to set up their own independent type forum groups. And yeah, drop me a line, and I'll keep you in touch with what's happening, not just London Forum, but other things in London, other things in Britain that need our support. I'm going on a there's a white man march in Liverpool on the 15th of August, Napoleon's birthday, 15th of August. So if you're in Liverpool, come on the white man march. It's going to be very exciting.
All right. Very, very good. Is there any other websites or anything you'd like to give out? I know you had some magazines maybe you wanted to mention as well.
Oh, yes. Candor. Candor's a good magazine. There's a very good article in September issue of Candor called "Is There a Conspiracy? And If There Is, Does It Matter?" by some chap called Jess Turner. It's a play on Chomsky's view that there isn't a conspiracy, and if there is, it doesn't matter. And then there was a very good article in the next issue by Hereward Moore about Richard III, which is well worth reading. Richard III was the last British king to die in battle, a good king. And he thought that, you know, there's one crime, he said, that cries out to heaven for justice. One crime, worse than all others. It wasn't murder, it wasn't rape, it wasn't burglary, it was usury. Now think about that, usury. You know, that's not a crime anymore, but then it was, you know. He was a very good king. The latest issue, another article by Jess Turner called Fighting Evil. So there's a website for that, that's good. What else? EKP website, the European Knights Project, that's South African website, that's very good. Yeah, there's Mjolnir magazine's a good magazine. Have you heard of that?
Oh, Mjolnir? Yeah, sure have. Yeah,
that's a good one.
Yeah,
and I'll probably think of some more. There's a good DVD come out by Telling Films by Lady Michelle Renouf, runs that film company, and it's a DVD, double DVD, called Valiant for Truth, and it's all about Horst Mahler.
Mm.
Horst Mahler was in the Baader-Meinhof Red groups in Germany, then saw the light, and he's now quite ill. He's had a foot amputated, and the German government has banned any marches to commemorate his death. He's not even dead yet, but there we are.
Wow.
And, recommend one book as well, if sure. I may. John Bean's brought out a book called Blood in the Square. John Bean was the leader of the incarnation of the second British National Party in the late 50s, 60s. And this is a fictional book about his experiences in that organization. Very good organization. I think that's everything. David Irving, check his website out. That's the website.
Always. I'd love to get him on. We never got in touch with him. I heard he doesn't do too many podcasts or radio shows, unfortunately. I guess I have to try to get him on camera or something, do an on camera interview or something. Would be great.
Yeah, I mean, he gave a speech at the London Forum last week.
That's great.
Yeah, go on YouTube, London Forum. He's on there giving a talk about saturation bombing in World War II. Who is to blame?
Great. Yeah, see, it was just uploaded here, when we recorded this interview 7 hours ago. So, yeah, it's right there.
All right. Well, he's a historian. I mean, you know, he that's what he is. He's, you know, he is a very good historian. He's not so much an interviewer or this or that. Or, you know, he's a talking head. He's a historian. But he's got a very nice Rolls Royce, I've got to say. Very nice Rolls Royce.
Right.
Yeah, I was chatting to him the other day over the bonnet of this Rolls Royce, and I thought, well, yeah, that's a very nice car. The guy's got style, I've got to say that.
He sure does. All right, very good. We'll have the links up here. We'll add a link to the email as well that Jess mentioned, and the London Forum YouTube channel as well. Do check it out, folks. A lot of good speakers and thinkers who are concerned about many of the questions we've been addressing here so far. But we'll take a short break. Stay with us, Jess, and stay with us, ladies and gentlemen. We'll be right back. Ladies and gentlemen, this is an independent radio program that has been seeking answers and truth since 2006. We've been running the website since around 2001, 2002. We are 100% independent and we do not have commercial interruptions in our programs, and we spare you from ads on the website. We do offer memberships, however. Please sign up for one and tune in to the second hour of this broadcast and, of course, all our previous programs and all the other video productions we've done over the years. RedIceMembers.com is the website. It's only €5 per month. Sign up for a 3-month subscription and try it out. We have a lot of material for you. We want to give you a side of the story that you will never hear in the mainstream, or some alternative channels too, for that matter. So we will continue with Jess Turner here in the second hour, as we do when we return after the break. And it is a good second segment, by the way, that you shouldn't miss. We speak more about the future of Europe, and we also go into detail about the Schumrim and his speech in London, the full story. Thank you for listening. We'll talk to you after the break.